This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Thousands of books have been written about Abraham Lincoln, and as arguably the most well-known president in American history, at least for those of us in his home state of Illinois, you might wonder how much more there is to know. But there is another side to Lincoln that has not been as widely introduced to the public, and that is the man he was in private. In fragmented notes, Lincoln documented his thinking, ideas that were sometimes later drawn on for speeches or when he needed to lay out his arguments in debates. More than 100 of these notes have been archived, and our guest today says they're the closest thing to a diary by our 16th president. Ronald C. White is a historian, lecturer, and author of the new book, Lincoln in Private: What His Most Personal Reflections Tell Us About Our Greatest President. In it, he explores 12 of Lincoln's notes, providing historical context and analysis for each. We originally broadcast this conversation a few weeks ago. If it's new to you, you can always find the whole thing on our podcast feed. Just search your podcast app for The 21st, or you can find links on our website, 21stshow.org. Okay, here now is my conversation with historian Ronald C. White. Ron, welcome to The 21st. Thank you for being here.
Brian, thank you for the invitation. Delighted to be with you in Lincoln's home state.
So I want to begin, before we get into some of the individual notes that you write about, you encourage the reader to embark on their own sort of personal journey and use these notes to discover sides of Lincoln that may be different from the Lincoln they've seen before, as you write in the book. Can you talk about some misconceptions people might have about Lincoln to which these notes speak?
Well, yes, Brian, Lincoln was, by his own definition, a very rational person. Remember, he had grown up in Kentucky, then in Indiana, in what was called the Second Great Awakening. His parents were members of Baptist churches. And as a young boy, really, he reacted against the emotionalism of that kind of religion and determined that he would always be a rational person. So in his public life, he almost never expressed his feelings. But he does in these notes. And so we hear some things about Lincoln from Lincoln that we don't hear in the public Lincoln.
Yeah, I love early on, one of the first chapters is about his impression of visiting Niagara Falls. And you quote from a conversation that was later recounted by his law partner, Herndon, in Springfield. And you say that Herndon wrote, he had no eye for the magnificence and grandeur of the scene, for the rapids, the mist, the angry waters, and the roar of the whirlpool. But of course, those of us who have seen Lincoln's private note on his visit to Niagara Falls, which I'm guessing at the time Herndon, you know, made that recollection of that conversation, probably Abraham Lincoln and maybe a handful of other people on earth had ever seen that note. It tells a very different story of his impression of the falls. Can you talk about that encounter of his?
It does. And Herndon actually goes on to say that Lincoln was heedless of beauty or awe. And the reason I began with this first note, the first chapter, written in 1848, is that here we see a Lincoln completely enamored of beauty and awe. A poetic Lincoln, if you will, a person who can write with such elegance about his impressions of his visit to Niagara Falls. This is a side of Lincoln, again, that we don't see in the traditional biographies of Lincoln. Herndon didn't know of this note, and so when he makes his comment, I suggest he's completely wrong about this Lincoln, who he thought he knew so well. It really is a wonderful, wonderful note. Let me just read the final portion of it, which is just fantastic. In that long, long time, never still for a single moment, never dried, never froze, never slept, never rested. And he ends with a comma, the reason that we call many of these notes fragments, because they are fragmentary. Somehow I think Lincoln was called away to some other task and he doesn't complete the sentence. But he is in this note an historian, a philosopher, a theologian, a geologist. He's remarkable in this note. This is a side of Lincoln that I wanted the public to see.
You know, it's so interesting to think that, you know, you write that Lincoln seemed like a closed book, even to his intimates. And you write about people like William Herndon in Springfield or Judge David Davis of Bloomington, who would have been riding the circuit court in central Illinois with Lincoln back then. You have spent decades studying Lincoln, reading his papers, thinking about him. It seems like you would have a better insight into who Lincoln was, perhaps, than his contemporaries did, because they didn't necessarily have access to the sort of panoply of his written output and all the historical records about him. I wonder if you shared any of those misconceptions before getting into these personal notes, or is that something that you've spent so much time on this that's in the past for you?
I actually did. The first time I really encountered Lincoln, I was teaching a course at UCLA in the history department. I didn't know very much. The Huntington Library in San Marino, California, had put on at that time the largest exhibit on Lincoln ever mounted. Much of it came from Springfield. And so I found myself kind of entranced by the second inaugural address. We can talk about that a few minutes later. And I wanted to find out the antecedents, so I went back to Brown University, where at that time a fragment about the address was there. So I knew of this one note, but I had to contact the Lincoln Papers Project in Springfield. I want to give great credit to Daniel Worthington, the project's director, and Kelly Clausing, then the assistant director. And I said, well, how many notes are there? Well, they had digitized notes from libraries all across the country. And they said, we believe there's 111 surviving notes. So in my book, for the first time, we publish all 111 notes. Now, I think Lincoln wrote hundreds more, but here's 111 surviving notes, which I think do paint a portrait of Lincoln that most of us don't really understand.
One of the amazing things about the notes is that as they're captured in the book, is you have these color plates, color photographs of the notes themselves. So we can actually see what they look like. And when I had first, started, I mean, these are just to give people a sense of it. These are full. They appear to be full sheets of paper. This is not, I kind of, in my head, this was sort of like the 19th century equivalent of Post-it notes stuck to the side of a computer monitor, maybe. But I mean, maybe you can just describe what these were, how he went about making these notes before we get into the content of some more.
Yes. Well, and I want to tip my hat to my publisher, Random House, for the possibility of publishing in color plates, 16 pages of these notes. That's not inexpensive to do. Lincoln wrote these notes. He never dated them, never titled them, never signed them. He never thought we'd ever see them. And that's what makes them so remarkable. As you suggested in your introduction, I sort of have sometimes called this Lincoln's intellectual diary. He didn't keep a formal diary. He didn't live to write his reminiscences as Ulysses S. Grant did, for example. So this is the closest thing we have. And the point is, he never thought we would see them. And so he says things that I think he wouldn't have said in public. He's kind of in advance of his ideas on slavery, but he's trying these ideas out for his eyes only.
And I want to come back to the specific notes on slavery and where he tries out his ideas there. But before we do that, you chose about a dozen of these to focus on in your book. You mentioned 111. Why did you choose the ones you did?
A tough choice. I chose 12 that I focus on in 10 chapters. I wanted, first of all, for the reader to see the range of Lincoln's thinking. I wanted them to see if there was something different than the sort of public Lincoln we think we know. I wanted in one note to show how Lincoln was just weighed down with a sense of defeat less than 4 years before he would be elected president of the United States. Lincoln often has been viewed as a person by traditional biographers who mostly read newspapers. No, he also read books. He wanted to read the other side of arguments. We don't do that today. But even in the midst of his debates with Stephen Douglas, he was reading books on pro-slavery. He didn't agree with the books, but he thought he needed to read these books. So this just gives us, I think, a wide angle picture of the breadth of Lincoln. Remember, this person had but 1 year of formal education, but I think a great quality of leaders I would like to see in leaders is what I would call intellectual curiosity. And Lincoln embodies intellectual curiosity.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. Listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with historian and author Ronald C. White. His new book is Lincoln in Private, What His Most Personal Reflections Tell Us About Our Greatest President. Okay, let's talk about some of these notes that deal specifically with the issue of slavery. In the third chapter, you share two of these fragments that show Lincoln building anti-slavery arguments. Some of the sort of the logical building of if a slave owner can become an enslaved person if they follow the same logics and beliefs that they have. For example, let's say you encounter someone with fairer skin or who has a higher intellect than them. As we've said before, these, you know, as I said in the introduction, some of these notes were later came up in speeches and debates. Can you talk about the role of these notes in the debates about slavery at the time?
Yes. Remember that Lincoln served one term in Congress, 1847 to 49. Then he came home and was a full-time lawyer from 49 to 1854. Then the Kansas-Nebraska Act was passed, led by Stephen Douglas, which allowed the possibility that slavery could now extend west into the territories. Lincoln, as I say in the book, held his fire for a while. He didn't offer a speech against Douglas. Finally, he would offer a 17,000-word speech. But in the meantime, he's thinking this thing out for himself. And let me read just this very brief note to himself. I think it's remarkable. If A can prove, however conclusively, that he may have right enslaved B, why may not B snatch the same argument and prove equally that he may enslave A? You say A is white and B is black. It is color, then, the lighter, having the right to enslave the darker. Take care. By this rule, you are to be a slave to the first man you meet with a fairer skin than your own. Oh, you do not mean color exactly. You mean whites are intellectually the superior to blacks and therefore have the right to enslave them. Take care again. By this rule, you are to be slave to the first man you meet with an intellect superior to your own. But say you it is a question of interest. And if you can make it your interest, you have the right to enslave another very well. And if he can make it his interest, he has the right to enslave you. Now, to my surprise, Brian, most of these notes do not appear in speeches. I suggest rather there's kind of his intellectual kind of thinking through issues. And this is remarkable. This is almost the Lincoln lawyer who is sort of saying, oh, here's the first argument, here's the second argument, here's the third argument, and then he overturns all three. This is the one note not held in Springfield. Fortunately, I have a friendship with Harlan Crow of Dallas, Texas, who has his own private library and his own private curator, and he owns this note, and he let me use it for this book.
You said this is Lincoln sort of thinking through issues. I was reminded reading some of these of that. It's a quote I've seen attributed to Flannery O'Connor as, "I write because I don't know what I think until I read what I say," or maybe Joan Didion had a simpler version, "I write to know what I think." Your argument is that that's what purpose these serve for Lincoln.
That's a wonderful way to say it. Yes.
Sticking with this topic of slavery, and obviously it was the big debate in the country at the time. That sort of is an obvious statement. Lincoln is often revered now for the Emancipation Proclamation and being morally opposed to slavery, but he was not an abolitionist, and people who were say he came slowly to the cause, right? He didn't believe black people should have the same rights as white people. He opposed, you know, them having the right to vote, serving on juries, holding office, intermarrying. Are there any of his sort of notes, these fragments that shed more insight into his perspective on the treatment of Black Americans in society?
Well, you've put your finger on the contemporary debate and the whole taking down of statues, taking the names of Lincoln off of public schools, not, I think, understanding fully that Lincoln was, in one sense, a man of his own time. But on the other hand, he's on a journey. And Lincoln's on a journey in terms of slavery. The reason that he's opposed to the abolitionists is that in one of the elections where Henry Clay was president, the abolitionists had the Liberty Party in New York State, who received 15,000 votes. That cost Clay the election to be president of the United States. And Lincoln called these abolitionists the righteous. He would really mean the self-righteous. So he was strongly anti-slavery. he didn't start this war to save the Union, to free the slaves, but it was to save the Union, but he's on a journey. And part of that journey, if I might suggest, is his trying to understand what he called the pro-slavery side of this debate. So in October of 1858, in the middle of his debates with Douglas, he's reading a book by a Presbyterian minister who's written a best-selling book on pro-slavery. This was a very prominent idea in Lincoln's day. Stephen Douglas called Lincoln the Black Republican 29 times in the first two debates. This fragment begins, "Suppose it is true that the Negro is inferior to the white in gifts of nature. Is it not the exact reverse justice that the white should, for that reason, take from the Negro any part of the little which has been given him? Give to him that is needy is the Christian rule of charity, but take from him that is needy is the rule of slavery." And as Lincoln goes into this note, and he often would speak his words, Brian, out loud before he put them on paper, you can hear him getting angrier and angrier. So he concludes, "But slavery is good for some people? Triple exclamation point. As a good thing, slavery is strikingly peculiar in this, that is the only good thing which no man ever seeks the good of for himself." I think these notes are often almost a pressure cooker for Lincoln. He's got a lot of anger inside of him, and he gets that anger out before he speaks it in public. A different topic, but we know that he wrote at least five letters that he never sent. Because I think the mark of leadership, oh, couldn't we learn this today, is to not simply say everything you think, but sometimes to withhold what you think until you can say it in a better way.
I love the contemporary references with multiple exclamation points, which is something many of us think of as an affliction of the modern email age. And, you know, the idea of, you know, they say, don't write that email in anger, write the email, don't hit send. Okay, we need to take a break here. More to come with our conversation with historian Ronald C. White. His new book is Lincoln in Private, What His Most Personal Reflections Tell Us About Our Greatest President. That's coming up after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just tuning in, we're continuing my conversation with Ronald C. White about his new book, Lincoln in Private, What His Most Personal Reflections Tell Us About Our Greatest President. Ron worked with the Papers of Abraham Lincoln in Springfield to share 12 of Lincoln's thoughts and arguments written on loose sheets of paper. The documents revealed thinking that would later come to be reflected in Lincoln's speeches and debates. Because this conversation was taped ahead of time, we're not taking calls for the rest of the show, but you can always let us know what you thought about our conversations. Send an email to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Or you can leave a voicemail at 217-300-2121. The number again, 217-300-2121. Okay, here's the rest of my conversation with Ronald C. White. We had a caller on the line. We lost the call, but Joan wanted to know where the notes came from. How were they found? And you write about in the book, boy, as soon as his son, Lincoln's oldest son, got word of the assassination, he and his Lincoln's two secretaries, John Hay and John Nicolay, were rushing to gather the papers. Can you talk about that process and how, you know, they might have known that these existed, and what happened to them in the years after Lincoln's death?
Yes, Robert Todd Lincoln first contacted Judge Davis, then an associate justice of the Supreme Court, who contacted the two secretaries, and they began gathering up Lincoln's papers. They were in desk drawers at the White House, in various places, and Davis then had them deposited in the bank in Bloomington. But he knew that Nicolay and Hay wanted to write a biography of Lincoln. So ultimately, he let the two secretaries write the biography, which was published in 1890. And then ultimately, the two secretaries published a collected works of Lincoln. And so they had custodianship of those notes. We don't know whether they kept or used them all. Perhaps even the son, Robert Todd Lincoln, might have thought, well, these are rather personal notes. I've often been asked, does Lincoln in these notes say anything about his marriage or about his children? No, he doesn't. Maybe the son might have thought, well, these are not notes that should ever be seen by the public. He might have destroyed them. And then the Lincoln Papers Project, to its credit, understood that these notes were then all over the country in various libraries, including the Huntington Library here in San Marino, California, and they digitized them. So that's why they're all present now in Springfield. I'm glad they're in one place.
You note that, and you mentioned earlier, that Lincoln never wrote a diary. He didn't live long enough to have a memoir as Grant did. But in the book, you sort of suggest that, well, maybe someday there'll be some dusty attic where we find one. Can you talk about, is there reason to believe that there may be some sort of more cohesive personal set of recollections and reminiscences from Lincoln? Or is that more sort of idle speculation?
Well, we have had from time to time letters of Lincoln show up. A dozen, maybe 15 years ago now, a woman in Ohio approached the Abraham Lincoln bookshop in Chicago and told Daniel Weinberg, the proprietor, she said, I think I have a letter from Lincoln to my great-grandfather who was a Republican congressman. Now, we hear this often at bookshop, at the Library of Congress and other places, Springfield. Most often it's not true. This was a genuine letter. And Lincoln wrote this letter to her great-grandfather, in which he said in the fall of 1859, when he was not thinking of being a candidate for president, whoever is the candidate of the Republican Party must be strongly slavery. If not, that would be, and he uses this remarkable word, idiocy. Now, the problem, however, is that letter was signed, so we know it's Lincoln. Remember what I said, these notes are not signed. So perhaps someone might find something in their attic, but I'm afraid they wouldn't understand it was Lincoln because there's no signature. So I really don't expect any new notes to appear. Maybe letters, but no notes.
Interesting. Well, I'm glad you mentioned this idea of political party and the birth of the Republican Party, because you focus on that in one of the chapters in the book and sort of Lincoln's concern with joining the new Republican Party after he had been a Whig for his entire life. Today, I think people who are coming up today are used to this idea. We have two political parties, Democrats, Republicans. People rarely move back and forth, but it was pretty common back in the mid-1800s for people to switch, I gather. Can you talk about, as Lincoln was considering the pros and cons of the Republican Party, he thought about being associated with nativists and the anti-immigrant sentiments that were growing around the country. His views on immigration are not as much talked about or brought up as his views on slavery, for example, but we do get some insight into what he thought. When it came to these nativist ideologies, what were Lincoln's concerns?
Yes, Lincoln was late in joining the Republican Party. I say so because he was a loyalist. That was his DNA. He was loyal to the Whig Party, but then he understood that the Whig Party didn't really have a future, so he joined the Republican Party. Basically an anti-slavery party, but it also embraced nativists. Who were the nativists? These were people who were very concerned in the 1830s and 40s and now 1850s of a new mass migration of Catholics who were coming from Catholic countries into what was basically a Protestant country. So Lincoln was very worried about nativism. He wrote a remarkable letter to his best friend, Joshua Speed, now residing once again in Kentucky. And he said, this nation began by saying all men are created equal. As he re-entered politics, he made the Declaration of Independence the foundation of all of his political speeches. Then we got to the place of saying, all men are created equal except Negroes. Now, if we're going to get to the place where we're going to say all men are created equal except Negroes and Catholics, I think I will emigrate to some other country, Russia, for example, where they take their immigration policies without the hypocrisy of ourselves. So it's really important again today to recognize that nativism, this sense that we are a white country or a white Protestant country, has always been a problem. And Lincoln saw that as a problem in the formation of the Republican Party.
No, history is right. I think I've heard it recently said that the past is the past, but history is what the present thinks about the past, right? And there are always going to be, one imagines, reevaluations of figures from the past. Can you talk about this? You mentioned it earlier. We touched on this idea of the reappraisal that's been happening across the country, Confederate monuments coming down, but not just Confederate monuments. Here in Illinois, on the state Capitol grounds, they moved Stephen Douglas's statue from outside the Capitol building, where he had stood sort of overlooking the statue of Abraham Lincoln. He was a little bit closer to the Capitol building in Springfield. And there are places where people say Lincoln, his own personage, should be removed from, college campus quads, school names, as you mentioned. What do you make of that reappraisal that's happening now, and as it spreads to include Lincoln himself?
Well, I'm concerned that this whole debate says a lot more about us than it does about the figures whom we are discussing. Lincoln had a great understanding for the fact that people lived within the context of their own time, that the Declaration of Independence was a promissory note, so to speak, that had to be continually expanded. So I'm deeply concerned that we are unwilling to accept people in their own time. I want to know, what did Frederick Douglass think of Abraham Lincoln? Do we know the story that after the second inaugural address, Douglass goes to the White House, twice he's pushed out by police and army, and he gets in and Lincoln says, "What did you think of my address, Mr. Douglass?" "Oh, I don't need to tell you, much more important people." "No, please, I want to know what you thought, Mr. Douglass." "I thought it was a sacred effort." Well, if Frederick Douglass, the greatest African American of the 19th century, thought this was a sacred effort, and who are we? I think we are often coming across and will in the future as so morally superior to these people. Stephen Douglass was an important Illinois senator. I don't think Abraham Lincoln would countenance for one moment removing Stephen Douglass. He didn't agree with him, but he respected him. And I think we have to teach history a little bit better if we're going to approach these issues today.
Why do you think people keep coming back to Lincoln? Obviously, here in Illinois, he is, you can go through the phone book and find your Lincoln towing and Lincoln this and Lincoln that. But I mean, it's so much more than that. I mentioned probably more books in what is this? I'm sure you've heard this, more books in the English language about Lincoln and Churchill, second only to the Bible in terms of what's been written about him in particular. What is it about Lincoln that keeps drawing people back, that draws you back?
Well, let me tell you a story that answers that question. In 2009, the State Department contacted me and asked if I would speak in Germany. People had been staying away from all of the embassies of the United States during the Iraq War, and the State Department wanted to bring them back, and they told me they thought Lincoln would be soft diplomacy. So the first engagement was in Hamburg with 12th and 13th grade German teachers teaching English and history. And I asked them that question. I said, "Why are you interested in Lincoln?" And they said, "Well, we know American history, and we know George Washington, and we know Thomas Jefferson. But for us, Lincoln represents America. In our country, Germany, we have many great leaders who were born of aristocratic lineage. That's for us who Washington and Jefferson are. But Lincoln represents what is best about America, that you can start with almost nothing, with little education, and to use Lincoln's own words, the right to rise. So that's why I think, consciously or unconsciously, he is the most remarkable and greatest figure in American history."
It's interesting. This plays a role, this sort of humble background of his and the way he came up plays a role in the fact of how few of these fragments are surviving today. You said you suspected there were a lot more. Jefferson, Other founders lived on these estates their entire lives. Often they inherited them from ancestors. Lincoln was pretty itinerant in his younger days, as a bachelor would be, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, we have over 1,000 letters, I believe, between Jefferson and Adams, once rivals, but then friends in later life, because they could keep all these letters and make copies of them. Remember, Lincoln moves to New Salem. He sleeps in the back room of Dennis Offutt's store. Then as a young single man, he would board with families 3-4 weeks at a time, not exactly conducive to keeping notes. Even when he goes off to Congress in 1847, he lives in Mrs. Spriggs' boarding house in one room. So that's why we only have one note from the 1830s and 7 notes, Brian, from the 1840s. The notes really pick up in the 1850s as Lincoln settles down. And then we do have notes from his presidency, now no longer written on scraps of paper. And these notes are dated, but they're still notes to himself, and they are very valuable.
We're almost out of time. I want to ask, you write in the book that reading these notes gives one the sensation of being in the room with Lincoln himself. You have spent a lot of time sort of in the room with Lincoln throughout your writing career. Can you talk about how these notes are different from other sources, letters, things that you've read with him?
Well, the Gettysburg Address is remarkable, as is the second inaugural address, but those are public documents. We know the background of those stories. We know often the various versions of those addresses. But here it's almost like we're in the room or we're looking over the shoulder. We're privileged to be with him as he's thinking out loud, putting it on paper, and never expecting any of us to ever see it. And that's what I find so exciting, that we are able to see it. And this offers a portrait of what I call the private Lincoln behind the public Lincoln.
Well, Ron, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today on the 21st and share your book with us.
Well, Brian, it's been a delight to do this with you, and thank you for your very judicious and thoughtful questions.
Ronald C. White is a historian and author. His most recent book is Lincoln in Private, What His Most Personal Reflections Tell Us About Our Greatest President. And that is all the time we have for our program today. Before we go, I do want to make a pitch for joining our texting group. We hear interesting things from listeners. It does inform our coverage. You can join by texting the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, just text the word TALK to 217-803-0730. You can also stay up to date with us on Twitter. Just search for 21STShow. We tweet out links with more analysis and background about what we've been talking about. All of these ways to contact us, if you want to also leave us a voicemail, send an email, or follow us on social media, it's all at our website, 21stshow.org. While you're there, you can also subscribe to our podcast. Our program is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Chantal Vaca is our engagement producer, and our interns are Zainab Qureshi and Brielle Skullark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.